All right, so we have made it in the life of Jacob up to Genesis chapter 37. So last week, we dealt with a whole bunch of things. And we saw that the reunion with Esau went better than expected. Then we had the terrible incident where Simeon and Levi avenged a sexual assault on their sister Dinah by slaughtering a bunch of people at Shechem. Jacob then makes it to Bethel, where the covenant gets renewed, and we get this reminder that his name is now Israel, which basically means God struggles and reminds us that Jacob had a lot of struggles in his life and he overcame them. And then Rachel died, giving birth to their 13th child, if you count all of the wives together, which was Benjamin. So 12 sons, one girl that we know of. And that gets us to this point where we finally begin to focus more on Jacob's children, but we're going to study this from the perspective of Jacob, and it's really interesting, and we get to yet another bonkers episode in the life of Jacob. It's kind of amazing how many of them he has. Although he has a very long life, it's still incredible. So we're picking up in 37, and we think when we pick up in this chapter, Jacob is probably 108 years or so old at the beginning of the chapter, something in that neighborhood. Jacob lived in the land where his father had stayed, the land of Canaan. And we think he's back in the area around where Isaac lived near Hebron. Then we're told this is the account of Jacob. So everything we've been reading about Jacob's life has technically been part of the account of Isaac. And that's kind of how Genesis works. Whichever account you're in focuses more on their kids. And that seems consistent with the Hebrew outlook that your kids are an extension of you. And so now we get Joseph becoming very prominent. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah. Don't know why Leah's not mentioned, but we think this is talking about his 10 older brothers, which includes sons of Leah, sons of Bilhah, and sons of Zilpah. Benjamin, at this point, would be too young to be out working with them. And Joseph brought their father a bad report about them. We don't know whether the bad report was accurate or not. We're not told that. Stands to reason, based on everything we know about Joseph, that he probably is accurate here. But you can imagine it did not make his brothers happy. So here we get the first reason his brothers are not happy with Joseph. Now we get another reason. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age. So he's kind of, the reason Moses mentions is that Joseph is the baby of the first group of sons. I think that's probably not the only reason he's the golden boy, so to speak. I think another reason is that it's clear from everything we've been studying, Rachel was the favored wife. He is the son of Rachel. I think as you go on later on, you find out that Joseph also is really good looking. He also turns out to be extraordinarily capable. So he's kind of that annoying brother who's literally good at everything. And I think that's probably why he also emerges as the favored child. And yes, if he was your sibling, that would be really annoying. But as we're going to see, there are righteous ways to respond to that, and there are sinful ways to respond to it. And even though it is certainly not good parenting for Jacob to make it obvious that he loves Joseph, the way the brothers react to it is sinful. And we get this interesting comparison as the story goes on of how you react to unfair situations and what that says about you. So Joseph signals his favoritism by making a richly ornamented robe for him. And some translations might say a robe of many colors. Modern commentators aren't sure that the robe is actually multicolored. Maybe it was, but they think the term more so applies to some sort of rich ornamentation. But as we're going to see, it's something that you can see at a distance that marks it out as unique. And so it could be many colors. The traditional translation could very well be right. We just don't know that for sure. So when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated him and could not speak a kind word to him. So a common way to deal with an unfair situation is to get grumpy and snarky. Doesn't make that reaction right, but something we probably all have done at one time or another. Then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves of grain out in the field," which is weird because we don't know of them really being farmers, "when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." And so his brothers instantly see the implications. "Do you intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And if you look at it more literally, what they're saying is essentially like, reigning? Will you really reign over us? Ruling? Will you really rule over us? And so they immediately get the idea of dominance, of ruling, and they don't like it, and they make it clear in Hebrew, when you get that kind of repetition, that's kind of their equivalent of saying very or really, and they're like, really? Now we have to deal with this, even though you are the little brother, and everyone knows in this culture, that means we should be higher status than you. Now we're going to lose that. Like the one thing we had over you, now we're going to lose that too. Then Joseph had another dream, and he told it to his brothers. So there's a lot of debate among the commentators about whether Joseph is being mean to his brothers and he's needling them, or whether he's just clueless 17-year-old. But it does seem interesting that he didn't seem to understand his brother's reaction, and so he goes for a second round. "Listen," he said, "I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had?" More loosely, "What is this nonsense? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" And so what Israel's calling out is, it's really bad in that culture to think of the son as greater than the parents. In that culture, your kids are an extension of you. You get credit for everything they did. So in theory, it's impossible for the child to be considered greater than the father. And so this is really insulting in that culture. And Israel catches the implication immediately. There are a lot of questions about what he says. Who does he mean when he says, "Will your mother and I?" Because at this point, Joseph's biological mother is dead. So who does he mean by "your mother"? There are a lot of different theories out there, including that he means Rachel. I think what struck me is the best explanation is that he means Leah, that Leah is essentially acting as the matriarch of the whole household at this point. And so he's saying, will your mother, Leah, and I, who are the people that should be the leaders of this family, actually be bowing down before you as well as your brothers? And then we're told his brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the matter in mind. And so one of the interesting things that Moses does in this passage is he doesn't tell you whether the dream is a vision from God or not. He just lays it out there as a dream. And what that technique does is I think it makes it easier for the reader to see both perspectives on the situation. You have Joseph's perspective, who thinks somehow God's got this special destiny for me, and it's a real vision. Then you have the brother's perspective that, oh my, this is one more annoying thing from our little brother. What is this foolishness, these delusions of grandeur? And Moses at this point leaves it ambiguous for the reader. And Israel's kind of in the middle. He doesn't like the implications, but he also doesn't just dismiss it. So he kind of tucks it away in his mind. And so that's where we're at. That's kind of the setup for what happens next. Joseph is the golden boy. His brothers hate him. Israel isn't sure what to think. All right, questions, comments, concerns at this point? All right, let's keep going. Now, an unknown amount of time passes. We don't know, so it's not entirely clear whether Joseph is still 17 when the rest of the chapter happens. Maybe he's 18. Seems pretty clear. He's still pretty young. And we're told, now his brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. So back near the trouble spot, Shechem. Probably a three-day journey from where Israel is. And remember, Israel is now like 108, 109 years old, something like that. So he's not out taking care of the flocks anymore. And Israel apparently gets worried, wants to know what's going on with the flocks. So he said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. Come, I am going to send you to them. So this suggests that Israel is trying to protect Joseph, which ironically probably annoyed the brothers even more. Look, he's the golden boy, and he doesn't even have to work like we do. But Joseph is obedient, so he agrees, and Israel says, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with the flocks, and bring word back to me. So Israel isn't able to do the work himself, but he's still interested in how it's going, and so he wants a report, and so he sends Joseph off to journey from the valley of Hebron all the way up to Shechem. When Joseph arrived at Shechem, a man found him wandering around in the fields and asked him, what are you looking for? He replied, I'm looking for my brothers. Can you tell me where they are grazing their flocks? They have moved on from here, the man answered. I heard them say, let's go to Dothan, even further north. So there's a lot of debate about this little incident. Who is this unnamed man that Joseph seemingly encounters by random? Some of the traditional Jewish interpretations were that it's an angel. There's nothing in the text, I think, that would tell you that. I think it's more likely that it's just a man. And this is the first of a series of remarkable coincidences of timing. And I would argue the reason we're given these remarkable incidents of timing is to make it clear that God's providential hand is behind all of this. And so we're eventually going to find out what the brothers do is their own choice, and they're doing it for evil, but God has a different plan. And the implication is, even though what's about to happen to Joseph is terrible, God is in control of it, even though the brothers are making their own free, evil choices. So very complicated, and one of the ways I think Moses does that is he shows us these amazing, remarkable incidents of timing that if any one of them hadn't occurred, the whole episode doesn't happen. And so this is the first one. If Joseph can't figure out where the brothers are, then he turns around and goes home. But lo and behold, as he's wandering around, he happens to encounter a stranger, and that stranger happens to have overheard where the brothers were going. So he goes even further away from Israel's protection to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. So in the police world, and some of you know this better than me, we have crimes of planning, and then we have crimes of opportunity, where a situation arises, you get hit with temptation, and you act without much pre-planning. I would argue this is what we call a crime of opportunity. So they see him coming. They probably recognize him by his special robe, probably reminding them of all the reasons they hate him all at once. He's daddy's favorite. Oh, here he comes to tattle on us again, right? So all those feelings come rushing back, but it is kind of remarkable and scary that they immediately take that to, let's kill him. Let's kill our brother. It's kind of amazing, as you think about Pentecost and Don's sermon and what happens here. Here we have the majority of the people of God, and a big chunk of them are sitting around talking about their brother. And that's what God uses to save the world as part of his plan. So this whole episode is kind of a bonkers thing. All right. So they see him coming. They plot to kill him. Here comes that dreamer, they said to each other. Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams. And so unbeknownst to Israel, after all his efforts to protect Joseph, he's actually sent him into the lion's den, so to speak. He sent him now at this point probably 4 days away from his own ability to protect him. And he's actually sent him to his biggest threat, which is his own brothers. When Reuben heard this, he tried to rescue him from their hands. And I think Moses presents Reuben's intentions here as genuine and sincere. Let's not take his life, he said. Don't shed any blood. Throw him into this cistern here in the desert, but don't lay a hand on him. So in other words, don't kill him with your bare hands. Leave him in the desert to die. So I would argue not the nicest alternative. He's still saying Joseph's going to end up dead, but he has a secret plan in mind. Reuben said this to rescue him from them and take him back to his father. So Reuben's plan is, I will loop back, I will get him out of the cistern, and everything will be okay. But I'm not willing to confront my brothers and tell them that, so I'm going to do it secretly. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the richly ornamented robe he was wearing. They took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. So they've tossed him down into a pit that he can't get out of. And then they sit down to eat lunch. So just remarkably cruel. So as they sat down to eat their meal, and we later learn that Joseph is pleading with them to get out of the cistern, they look up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. So Gilead is off to the east. So they're probably coming from Mesopotamia. They're probably going to travel down through Canaan to Egypt, trying to do the old buy low, sell high thing. So this is our second big coincidence, that as Joseph is sitting in the cistern and the brothers are contemplating what to do with them, a caravan just happens to come by at that moment. Their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. And we're eventually going to hear them referred to as Midianites. I'll talk about that in a minute. Judah said to his brothers, so one of the things we're going to start seeing is Judah emerging as a leader among the brothers. What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? In other words, we don't gain anything material from that, and we all know it's a bad thing to kill your own flesh and blood. Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood. So we'll just take it down a notch in terms of criminal level. We'll sell him into slavery. His brothers agree. So Judah evidently is persuasive. I would say you could look at what he does in two different ways. In one sense, he's bolder than Reuben because he's able to confront the brothers and try to steer them in a different direction. The disappointing thing is that he's just steering them to a slightly less horrible destination. Reuben was not willing to confront the brothers, but he at least wanted to rescue Joseph. So when the Midianite merchants came by, we aren't sure why Moses flips back and forth between calling them Ishmaelites and Midianites. One rationale is that those regions overlap, and so it's like Midianite is a more precise term than Ishmaelite. So they are Ishmaelites from the region of Midian, you could say. His brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. When Reuben returned, and we weren't told that Reuben went away, but here we get the third kind of remarkable incident of timing, which is something came up that pulled Reuben away from the group. And it just so happens that while he's away, the other brothers sell him into slavery, therefore foiling Reuben's plan to rescue Joseph. So without any of those three remarkable coincidences don't happen, the whole thing falls apart. Joseph doesn't get sold into slavery. Okay? When Reuben returned to the cistern and saw that Joseph was not there, he tore his clothes. He went back to his brothers and said, "The boy isn't there. Where can I turn now? So what can I do?" Interestingly, he chooses to join the conspiracy at this point. So he doesn't go back to Israel and say, "Hey, all those dudes just sold your favorite son into slavery." And you can kind of understand why he wouldn't have. One is it would have earned his brothers enmity. But the other thing is that the next question is, well, why didn't you stop it? Well, you see, I had this plan. And then something came up with the sheep, and so I left your favorite son in a cistern with people who wanted to kill him. But I took care of that other problem for you, right? That doesn't look very good to Israel, right? So I think at this point, he realizes, in his own self-interested, sinful view, my best option at this point is to join the conspiracy because I wouldn't gain any ground with anybody if I tried to say, hey, I planned to stop it. I just wasn't competent enough to stop it. Okay. It's kind of remarkable that they all agree and they all pull off the secrecy. So they got Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They probably tore up the robe too. They took the ornamented robe back to their father, and they said, "We found this. Examine it to see whether it is your son's robe." So it's kind of like, we found this, we aren't sure what it is. You look at it, maybe you can figure it out, when they know very well exactly what it is. Israel recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. Some ferocious animal has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." And then I think the brothers realize how evil their plan is when they see Jacob's reaction. "Then Jacob tore his clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned his son many days." So we know from other passages that this culture often had designated periods of mourning. So for example, when Moses dies, we're told Israel has this official period of mourning for 30 days. Whatever the expected period of mourning was, the implication is Israel's grief goes on way longer than expected. And so it gets to the point where we're told all his sons and daughters came to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And I don't think they would have tried to do that right away. You were expected to grieve when you lost a child. You were expected to grieve a long time. But it finally gets to the point where his family members, and we think it's talking about his sons and daughters-in-law, are like, "We're really worried about you. You need to get it together." And he isn't willing. "No," he said, "in mourning will I go down to the grave to my son. Or in mourning will I go down to Sheol, the place of the dead, to my son." And so in the Old Testament, we see glimpses of the hope of resurrection, that someday in the future there will be a resurrection and that the people of God will experience this wonderful promised existence. But what we don't see in the Old Testament is the idea that emerges in the New Testament that if you pass away, you're immediately in the presence of God. And you know how all our cartoons and our culture have this happy little picture of heaven with angels and harps and gold, and even people who aren't really Christians kind of assume that's where you immediately go when you die. That doesn't exist in the Old Testament. And so they talk about the netherworld, which they call Sheol, the place of the grave, and it's this gloomy place where you sort of await this resurrection at the end. And so what he's saying, in essence, is he thinks Joseph is already there. He's going to go to him someday. Joseph isn't going to come back. Okay? So not a happy thought. The idea that we get from the New Testament is much more pleasant and kind of an example of progressive revelation. All right, questions, comments, concerns about that? All right, so yeah, go ahead. So I don't think so. I don't think he wants to die. I think what he's saying, in essence, is nothing good is ever going to happen again. I mean, he's depressed. And so I will continue in a state of grief for as long as I live, is I think what he means. As we're going to see, he's going to live a long time. And while I don't think he ever forgets the loss of Joseph, and we're going to see how that affects his actions for the rest of his life, he does eventually stop the formal mourning at some point. But this is how he feels in that moment. I'm never going to stop mourning. All right. So if you look at page 5 of the notes, if you have them, this is the third episode of crazy deception in Jacob's life. And the first one, he was one of the perpetrators, and Isaac was the victim. The second one, he's the victim. Laban is the perpetrator. This one, he's the victim again. His sons are the perpetrator. And once again, a sibling is involved as a victim. And so it is remarkably weird, all the parallels. I will say the parallels between this episode and the first two aren't as tight as the parallels between the first two. But we have a situation where the victim favors a family member for non-spiritual reasons. So we have Israel favoring Joseph over siblings because Joseph was born in his old age and probably the connection to Rachel as well. We have the older brothers being jealous. Then Israel isn't able to see what actually happens. It's not because he's blind. It's because he's not present because of distance. We have goat being involved again. And then we have Israel mourning for Joseph while mistakenly believing Joseph was dead. So we have another solemn rite involved in this. And once again, we're eventually going to find out the Lord's aware of it and doesn't stop it. And we'll come back to that idea at the end because I think that's important. Okay. Now we're going to jump forward. So 22 times, because we're going to focus on what happens from Jacob's perspective. And so after this, you probably have heard the story of Joseph. Joseph goes down to Egypt. Remarkably, we're told the Lord is with them, even though he's a slave in Egypt. A whole series of more unfair things happen to Joseph. But eventually, he gets elevated to an official for Pharaoh, becomes the chief administrator of Egypt, in part because he foresees that there's going to be 7 years of plenty in Egypt, and then there's going to be 7 years of terrible famine. So if you jump forward to the beginning of the famine, he's now married at this point. He's probably been in Egypt something like 20, 21, maybe even 22 years, something in the time frame of 20 to 22 years. And the famine is starting, okay? The famine is so bad, it even affects Canaan. And let's pick up at 41, verse 51. So we're told Joseph, he marries an Egyptian woman. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." So Joseph can finally say, after 20 years or so, "I can forget this horrible thing that was done to me." Then he has another son, and he says, "It is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." So Joseph is finally healing from what he's done, and he's getting ready. And then the famine comes, and we're told, if you skip down to 57, all the countries came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was severe in all the world. So this is a terrible famine affecting where Israel and the older brothers are as well. So in 42, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you just keep looking at each other?" He continued, "I have heard there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die." So at this point, Jacob is close to 130 years old. Working backwards, something in that neighborhood. So I think even more so than in the previous episodes, the older brothers would now be the operational leaders of the family, and they aren't sure what to do, and you can imagine why. When a famine's going on, you have no idea how long it's going to last. There's danger in staying and hoping things will turn around. There's danger in trying to leave. And so it would be easy to see how you would end up in paralysis by analysis. And so Jacob asserts his patriarchal authority and basically says, "You need to stop doing nothing or we're all going to die." And so there's grain down in Egypt, so get a move on and get down there and get grain. Then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. And it's interesting how things have flipped from the previous chapter. So remember, in the previous chapter, the older brothers were away, and Jacob sends Joseph on a dangerous mission to go to the older brothers, who, unbeknownst to Joseph, are hostile. Now we have Joseph is away, the older brothers are being sent on a dangerous mission, and they have no idea how dangerous it's going to be. Then 10 of Joseph's brothers, so the older brothers, went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm might come to him. Oh, wait, there's another parallel. We've got the other son of Rachel, who's now an adult but a young one, and we're going to hold him back, just like we held Joseph back. So Jacob still has not learned the lesson of differentiating between his children. He's still trying to protect one of them. So Israel's sons were among those who went down to buy grain, for the famine was in the land of Canaan also. Now Joseph was the governor of the land, the one who sold grain to all its people. So when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. So as it turns out, they did fulfill the dream about the sheaves. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but then he makes a spur-of-the-moment decision. He doesn't tell them, but he pretended to be a stranger and spoke harshly to them. "Where did you come from?" "From the land of Canaan," they replied, "to buy food." Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. And I think Joseph has a lot of advantages at this point. One is that it's much easier to recognize a group of 10 people together in a group than it would be to recognize one. Another thing is that at this point, Joseph has adapted to Egyptian culture, which includes a shaved head. So big difference between how his brothers would have last seen him. The people in the land of Israel were big shaggy hairstyles, and he also likely has on makeup. Men and women in ancient Egypt, everyone says, wore makeup, especially eye makeup, and he's probably wearing Egyptian clothes, and he's 20 years older, so you can understand why the brothers don't recognize him, but he's able to recognize them. And so he says, and he remembers his dream when he sees them bowing down, and he says, "You are spies. You have come to see where our land is unprotected." And what this does is it gives him an excuse to grill them about what's going on with the family without revealing that he's asking it because he wants to know what's going on with his dad and his brother Benjamin. Okay. And so they go back and forth, and where it lands is first he says, "All right, all of you have to stay here, and one of you is going to go back and get this younger brother you've told me about." And then he puts him in prison for 3 days, and then he changes the plan and says, "Okay, now I'm going to let 9 of you go back. One of you will stay here as a hostage," just like Joseph had to stay in Egypt. And the one he picks is Simeon, which is interesting. Maybe that means Simeon was the ringleader in the scheme against him. Don't know. He does overhear Reuben say, "Hey, didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy, but you wouldn't listen?" So he knows that Reuben at least wanted to try and help him. And so maybe he just passes over Reuben for that reason and goes to the second oldest one. It wouldn't surprise me if Simeon were the ringleader. Based on what we know about what happened at Shechem, Simeon is not a nice person. All right. So then the last thing he does that really messes with their minds is, you remember, he puts the silver that they gave for the grain in their sacks. One of them figures it out on the way. It looks like when they get back to Israel, is when the rest of them figure out it happened to them too. So we'll pick up in verse 29. When they came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them. They said, "The man who is Lord over the land," not knowing they're talking about Joseph, "spoke harshly to us and treated us as though we were spying on the land. But we said to him, 'We are honest men. We are not spies. We were 12 brothers, sons of one father. One is no more, and the youngest is now with our father in Canaan.' So from their perspective, we were honest about who we were. Then the man who is Lord over the land said to us, 'This is how I will know whether you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers here with me. Take food for your starving households and go. But bring your youngest brother to me, so I will know you are not spies, but honest men. Then I will give your brother back to you, and you can trade in the land.' So if you prove you're honest, then you can come back and forth as much as you want. As they were emptying their sacks, there in each man's sack was his pouch of silver. When they and their father saw the money pouches, they were frightened." Same reaction they had on the way. And so at this point, the brothers know something divine is happening. It has something to do with what we did with Joseph. They're guilty. They know they deserve it, but they're kind of terrified because they have no idea what God is up to and how far this is going to go or how it's going to turn out. Jacob immediately seizes on the fact that this is going to look bad if they go back to Egypt, and that this is going to be evidence of dishonesty, that you didn't pay for your grain, you defrauded us, and so they're going to be viewed as spies or something worse, and now he's going to lose Simeon, and it would be foolish to send Benjamin. So their father Jacob said to them, "You've deprived me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more." So in Jacob's mind, Simeon's now as good as dead. We're never getting him back. "And now you want to take Benjamin. All things or everything is against me." So keep in mind, Jacob is the patriarch, the covenant heir, and at this point, he feels everything is against him. So he doesn't feel in this moment like God is protecting him. Cannot see that even a little bit. He thinks everything has gone wrong, and he doesn't know why. "Then Reuben said to his father, 'You may put both of my sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Entrust him to my care, and I will bring him back.' But Jacob said, 'My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm comes to him on the journey you are taking, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in sorrow.'" And so I think most of us could have told Reuben this is not the most persuasive argument. So what Reuben is trying to get across is, let me take Benjamin because I will do everything in my power to keep him safe, is what he's trying to get across. What he literally says is, if I don't pull that off, you can kill my sons. But I mean, what grandfather wants to kill his grandchildren? So that's not really much of an offer from Jacob's perspective. Jacob wants his grandkids, and he wants Benjamin, and he knows everything in Reuben's power is not enough to guarantee Benjamin will come back, or Simeon will come back. And he's concerned at this point that this guy down in Egypt is just messing with them and has no intention of letting Simeon go. And if Benjamin gets down there, he has no intention of letting Benjamin go. And so it's not like I think he's trading Benjamin for Simeon. I think he's honestly thinking, I don't want to lose both of them. But what he says would, I think, have been another round of hurt for the other brothers. He says, "My son will not go down there with you. His brother is dead, and he's the only one left." Well, he's not the only one left. You've got all these other sons too. But, you know, as they say, the truth comes out. Freudian slip. So whatever the brothers were trying to accomplish by getting rid of Joseph in relation to Jacob, it didn't work. Like, they weren't able to stop Jacob from favoritism by doing something sinful to Joseph. And I think this is kind of the important takeaway to remember from the brothers, that when we resort to sinful means to deal with injustices or hurts in our life, we don't actually make anything better. Sin as a coping mechanism never works out well, right? I can't tell you how many times when I've been sentencing people in court and they're explaining how they ended up in the position where they're now likely to go to the penitentiary, it starts with something terrible that happened to them, and then they coped with that by doing something like using meth or stealing something, and one thing led to another, and now they're here. And in that moment, when they're sitting in court, they can look back and see that was not a good way to handle that situation. But in the moment, when we're operating from the flesh, lashing out or hurting someone else seems like a way that will make us feel better and somehow help the situation. But it doesn't. And what's remarkable about Joseph is he experiences something maybe even more terrible, probably more terrible, than what the brothers experience. And somehow he does not lose faith. And he is able to maintain his attitude of faith and kindness to other people in terrible circumstances. And we see that he is able to accomplish something of incredible spiritual significance because he's willing to persevere through injustice that way. So when we get to Romans, so I think we've got time for this. Flip over to Romans 12. Verse 17 says, "Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everybody. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, 'It is mine to avenge, I will repay,' says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." And of course, Jesus is the ultimate model of this attitude. If you think about the injustice he endures, because he knows it's part of God's salvific plan, and it will be good for all of humanity, that's the ultimate expression of this attitude. But Joseph is a foreshadowing of Jesus and does something remarkable as well. He, just as a teenager, experiences this terrible thing, has every right to think, well, the Lord is against me, but he never gives up faith on the Lord. And because he's willing to endure that, that puts him in position to be the agent of salvation for the entire household. But only because he's willing to endure over 20 years of awfulness to get there. And so that's what God is looking for, is followers who can be part of his story of salvation in this world. But if you want to be part of it, what the Bible shows us over and over again is you can't expect life to be this parade where everyone around you is sitting there throwing ticker tape at you. You have to be willing to endure things that are unfair, that are unjust, to be willing to endure hurts and display the love of Christ in the midst of it. And if you do that, then you can accomplish something of eternal significance with your life in whatever situation God's put you through. That's what Joseph shows us. All right. I've used up all our time. Sorry. Better stop there.